I was told not to hide behind the microphone. I thought, oh, that's a good idea. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me. Joanne, thank you very much. We know a lot of the same people, and yet we've never met. So it's really nice to meet you finally. And I thank the women for who came up and shared, and because when you come up on the podium the way we were brought up in the program, you clean up, you show up, and you wear lipstick. As a shout out to my friend Christy, who that's when she got in early sobriety, she said her first sponsor said to her, "Don't worry about anything. Go to meetings, clean up, show up, and wear lipstick. The rest will take care of itself." So, thank you, Melody. Thank you, Elisa. Thank you, Mindy. And thank you, Marie. Marie was especially thrilled to be wearing a skirt this morning. I'd also like to thank my my wonderful husband, who is a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He has 15 years of sobriety, and I tell you that just because I'm extremely proud of him. And he is my biggest cheerleader and my best friend, and we make it work. And all I can ask for today is a willing partner, and he is. He's there. We you know, it's not perfect, but we're there for each other, and we do the best we can every day. And God has been very good to us. I also like to thank my beautiful daughter, who I gave her the option of being here today, and we spent the night in the hotel, and she just thinks, you know, nothing better than ordering, you know, $5 bagel from room service. I mean, life is large. It's so simple when you're nine, and, you know. And she said, you know, so I gave her the option of coming and listening to me, and she said, you know, Mommy, she thought about it. I'd really like to come and hear your performance today, but I really don't want to waste the day. So, I'm humble. It's okay. So, with that, I'd like to say that my name is Cindy S., and I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups. My home group is the new It's 6 O'Clock Somewhere, meeting at 6 o'clock on Thursday nights in Roswell at the St. David's Episcopal Church on Old Roswell Road. This meeting is about 6 weeks old, and it was started, and I'm going to use this word because I usually call us long-timers, but in this particular sense, we are all old-timers. We wanted an early meeting so that on our way home from work, we all live or work near the church, and we can get to a meeting and go home and go to bed. You know, the whole thought about going home and eating and then coming back out, most of us are just, you know, beyond that. And then some of us don't want to drive after dark either. So I mean it when I say old-timers. We just... but it's a wonderful group. It's the reason we called it At 6 O'Clock Somewhere was kind of a tip of our hat to our loved ones in AA who always had the excuse, it's 6 O'Clock Somewhere. So... And we have a lot of fun. And my story is a love story, and my story is a story of joy and a story of God's grace, I believe, in these rooms. God saved my life and brought me such joy and such blessings that I couldn't even have imagined to have asked for. And each day is just another blessing on blessing. And I stand here before you and I look out back and there's the lake, and even in winter there's such beauty in winter with the trees without their leaves and the cold and the wind, and it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous and reminds me again how good God is. I surrounded myself with a few things. I have on, I love frogs. My daughter knows I love frogs. I get frogs for everything. Frog stands for fully rely on God. So I'm wearing my frog necklace. I have my little origami frog for my daughter, which does jump. And last night we went out for dinner and she had to buy me a little joy rock. So she's right in there. And this morning I was, you know, talking to my husband, and I, you know, I'm nervous, obviously, and he said to me, honey, it just turned to me, and you know, I can't tell you enough how wonderful my husband is, but he just turned to me and says, I don't know anybody who works a better program than you. And to have that come from my husband is just, you know, the most wonderful thing, you know, because he gets me every day, day in, day out, you know, the good and the bad. And, you know, I stand here before you hopefully spreading a good message, but he gets to see my mess. So, anyway, so I'll start at the beginning. I came in, and the only reason I'm going to tell you this date is because it's important later on. I remember the day I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting. It was June 13, 1988. I was journaling at the time, and that's why I remember it, you know, it was written down. And so keep that date in mind. It's just the beginning of a long journey of grace, joy, hope, wonderfulness. And it wasn't always that way. I was born into a large family. There were I was the fourth of five children. A very religious home, very religious, but not a very spiritual home. And we worried a lot as a family. We worried a lot. And, you know, I learned that at my mother's knee. And you know, it says in the big book, alcoholism, alcohol is but a symptom. And this is very much a family disease, and I think that was covered yesterday in the panel. The only difference is the allergy. And there are not two sides of this disease. It is one disease. And there are not two sides of the program or the principles. There's Al-Anon and AA, and our principles are exactly the same. The only difference in the programs is I do not have the physical allergy to the drink. And but I can be just as crazy, stone cold sober, if you will, as any drunk when they're in a blackout. So I started, you know, my family is, I will say that my family is wonderful. My brothers, my sisters, my parents, it was a loving home, although I didn't feel at the time that I was loved. I felt when I was the fourth of five that there wasn't enough love. I felt that by the time they got down to the fourth one, there just wasn't enough to go around. And, you know, it never occurred to me, what I learned later, is that the more love you give, the more love you are able to give. And not that love doesn't divide. As you give it to people, it doesn't, you know, mean there's less and less. It means there's more and more, which is kind of a conundrum, but that's the way God works. As he creates more and more people, and we're all perfectly unique, there will be no one like me before me, and there's no one like me after me. I have the fingerprints of God on me, because my fingerprints are unique. And so God created me to be special, and that's all that matters. But I didn't know that at the time, and I just grew up with this hole. And I heard a term, I think it's in a song, but a God-shaped hole. It's that God-shaped hole in my soul. And you know, as I started growing up and feeling less than, and always comparing myself, that I wasn't, you know, pretty enough or tall enough or smart enough or whatever enough. There was never enough. I was never enough. And you know, I searched for something to make me enough. And as I slowly, you know, as I got into middle school and high school, I discovered what my drug of choice was, and that was men or boys. And always it was about they made me feel enough. And because if I could be something in their eyes, then I could be okay. And so, you know, I would, I started early. I remember eighth grade dance, and Chucky asked me to dance, and I remember that going home high. I mean, high as a kite, just like, woo! And that was my first, you know, high of the drug of my choice, just because this boy had asked me to dance with him. That was eighth grade. And through high school and college, I continued what I call my manalog, you know, the drunkalog in AA. You know, I was serially monogamous. But nonetheless, serially monogamous. I was always the next man because I didn't feel good. I couldn't be by myself. And I had already started acting out against girlfriends because they were competition. The man was more important than the friend. And I certainly didn't have integrity. I wasn't a good friend. And I wasn't honest and I wasn't truthful because I was always willing to dump you women at the drop of a hat to be with the guy. And to betray you to get the guy. And so, because that would make me feel better. The guy made me feel better. And as I got older and my disease progressed, my choices got more and more questionable. And I'm out of college at this point, and you know, I had put myself, I was living in New York City, and went to school in New York City, and lived and worked in New York City, and for 15 years, and I was dating only men who drank very heavily, blackout drinkers generally, and some drug abusers, but you know, they weren't really my favorite. I liked the drunks; they were fun. Drugs scared me, so. And you know, doing that, you know, partying in New York City. I lived and worked on the Upper West Side. Well, I lived on the Upper West Side, and there was a little bar there called the Abbey Pub on West 105th Street and Broadway, and it was just like Cheers. Just like Cheers Bar in Boston, the make-believe bar. I mean, everybody knew your name. It was a little bar, and everybody in the neighborhood came. And I could sit on a bar stool by myself and like have dinner and be safe and not be. It wasn't, you know, real sleazy. But of course, I knew all the regulars, and the regulars were the drinkers. And you know, I remember years later saying to a woman in AA that you know I met all these. The men that I dated all, you know, were, she's like, the men that you dated were all drinking heavily. You met them in a bar. Wow. You think? Just never occurred to me. Honestly, just never occurred to me. So anyway, the choices got worse and worse. And you know, blackout drunks and my chasing after men and you know, I call it my sine curve or reverse sine curve of men to my bottom, which was, you know, kind of starting up the younger days when they were okay and they just, you know, we were too young to drink then, you know. But, and then the bottom and then back up again, because right at the bottom of my sine curve, there was a bottom, and then the man that I dated right before the bottom, this blackout drinker who to this day I wonder if he's alive, and then the bottom and then back up, I dated him again. So... Because the man who broke me really was not a drinker. He was just very, very abusive. And emotionally abusive. And a New York City cop, as a matter of fact, and legally licensed to carry a gun, and slept with it under his pillow. And I was being broken down because I didn't feel like I was enough. And so I listened to everything he said. And it was all that abusive talk where, you know, I love you. I'm the only one who can love you this way. And you need to do this because I'm just here to help you. So, you know, wear certain things. And, you know, if I was running even a little bit late, how horrible I would be subjected to a rant about, you know, how inconsiderate and we need to be on time. And, you know, just very, very abusive. And a girlfriend of mine, a close friend of mine, who had left an alcoholic marriage, interestingly enough, never been in Al-Anon, that we never talked about it, but I knew she had was divorced from a man who was a very, very, very heavy drinker. She said to me, she said, you know, Cindy, you sound like, when I was talking to her about it, you sound like an abused wife. And I was just, you know, I was probably just a few weeks short of becoming physically abused. It was probably the next step in our relationship. And when she said that to me, you know, I got the God shot. It was all that mattered. And I broke up with him. And he stalked me. And it was quite frightening there for a while because, you know, he had a gun and he knew where I lived and he knew where I worked. And I mean, and it was just, I mean, I thank God that I got out of that relationship and I got out of it whole and alive and you know, moving on with my life. And so I ended up getting into therapy, and which was definitely God's gift because this woman was an AA, I did not know at the time, and she 12-stepped me later on. And I went, my very first meeting was in the bottom of Trinity Church in down in the shadow of the World Trade Center. And it's a huge noontime meeting for Wall Street, and people come and go. There's an AA, big AA meeting on one side of the hall, and a big Al-Anon meeting on the other side of the hall. And I had to laugh at Ann last night. It's so true. The alcoholics, they don't care. You come late, you leave early, you eat, you talk, you go out and you have a smoke. Al-Anons, we all whip around whenever somebody walks in the room, and you're late. Every group inventory is about who's late. Alcoholics are like, who cares? My husband says about my husband got sober at Skyland, and I used to attend Skyland Al-Anon very regularly, and he used to laugh about our group inventory. He'd say in the Al-Anon room, he said, "The thing I like most about Skyland is the alcoholics downstairs. The thing I like least about the Skyland Al-Anon is I can't hear what they're saying." Classic. So anyway, I went into the Al-Anon meeting on June 13th, 1988, and thought to myself, these people are crazy, and I'm not. I am not crazy, and I don't have alcoholism in my life. And I didn't. I did not grow up in active alcoholism. There's a story in how Al-Anon works, and that this woman. It's funny, the story's called Learning to Live Single, which was very important for me. But it starts out with, perhaps the most outstanding thing about my story is how far from outstanding it is. You know, it really, I didn't have any tremendous, it was all internal. It was all internal emotional upheaval and feeling sad and lonely and less than and always looking for solace in the next man. And I do remember when I first got into therapy, Susan, God bless her, saying to me, she says, "Cindy, nobody gets placed into their 20s miserable. You just don't all of a sudden wake up miserable. You know, this has been coming for a long time." And so we searched and we searched. We did family trees and never did find the active alcoholic. It's in there because the isms are all in there. You know, alcoholism is really a disease of behaviors. And I had all the relationship behaviors. And I had all the fear and uncertainty and doubt and worry. And, you know, when I first came in, I was so afraid. Fear ruled my life. And I was afraid to live and I was afraid to die. And I would get up and go to work every day and come home into my apartment in New York City and not talk to a soul. I didn't have to. My mother's greatest fear was that I would die in my apartment and no one would know. And, you know, because no one, it was entirely possible I could order takeout or I could stop by a bodega on the way home on Friday night and not have to come back out until, you know, Monday morning till work. So it's real easy to isolate and remain alone in New York City. And it worked for me for a while. So I started getting help and I went back to, I tried Al-Anon 3 times. Because she kept shooting me back, you know, I was going to swing out, she'd shoot me back into play. And she was one of the most spiritual women I know, and she just kept saying to me, you know, I think you'll feel better if you keep trying, just keep trying, I think you'll feel better. So I went to that Al-Anon meeting down at Trinity Church, the noon meeting, for 2 years. I went very regularly. It was every day they had a meeting. From 12 to 1:15. It took count for lunch hours. People could come and go, and there was a lot of coming and going because, you know, and people were rattling their plastic bags or eating, you know, their salads or whatever. You came, you eat, you listened, you shared maybe, and you left. And but it was fabulous because I could also remain anonymous in that meeting as well. And people who know me know why I have such a pet peeve about going around the room in a meeting. It just bugs me because it took me 2 years to raise my hand and share in that meeting. And when I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, I raised my hand and I shared. And it was a huge moment in my recovery when I claimed my seat. Because for 2 years I sat there. I went regularly. People knew who I was. Hi, I'm Cindy. But they didn't know anything else about me. And they were patient and they were loving. And when I finally got ready to say, I'm here, and I belong here, you know, that's when the real recovery began, and that was really when I started taking my first step. I realized that my life was unmanageable. I was powerless, and I knew I was crazy. I knew at this point that, you know, that there was definitely insanity in my life, and that something needed to change. So so I did start sharing, and my first 6 years were spent in the program in New York. I did not have a sponsor. I don't recommend that for people. But I did do, you know, have the third step, and I did have faith. I always had faith. The problem is, you know, because I had been grown up in a religious home. While it wasn't spiritual, I did have a God of my understanding, and actually my given name in my religion was Faith, which was interesting enough, and I picked that. So I did have faith that there was a God, and that that he was responsible for all things. The problem I had was it took me a long time to read the word care in the third step, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, that God was loving, God was caring, God was good. I had fear of God, and I just assumed that I had to be good for God to love me. And I just said this the other night, and I heard it from a dear friend in Al-Anon, and she says, God doesn't love me because I am good. God loves me because God is good. And it took me a long time to know that, so that regardless of my actions, regardless of what I did, God always loved me. God, and he still does. And no matter what I do, I can go back to God, and God can say, okay, could have done that better, but, you know, I love you, and go out tomorrow and do it a little bit better. And because at the end of the day, my behavior is between me and my God. And it really doesn't matter. My sponsor says this all the time. It really doesn't matter if you have a problem with my behavior. That's your problem. If I don't have a problem with my behavior, then it's okay. I mean, seriously, it's a self-diagnosed disease. If, you know, I can say to someone, your drinking bothers me, but if it doesn't bother them, it doesn't bother them, and it's not a problem. And same with my behavior. If it's okay with me and with my God, I'm sorry that it hurts your feelings, whatever it may be, or I'm sorry that you don't like it, but I'm okay with it. And that's taken a long time to realize that I'm a child of God and a person of worth, and that I try today to be esteemable, that I try to do the things that God would want me to do, to be the best Cindy that I can be today. That's all I can be. I can't be you. I can't be what you think of me. I can't be what I think you think of me. My husband always says that. Would you stop trying to read my mind? You really suck at it. Okay. And I'll look at him and say, well, then don't give me that tone of face. So... So I did, you know, when I finally got the care of God, I was in a long-term relationship with a man who was drinking and drugging, and I got into the relationship when I was in Al-Anon, and I met him. I'd known him from the bar for a long time, and he'd always drunk heavily, and, you know, so this was not a surprise to me. So I'm in the program, and I picked this guy. Of course, we date and mate, because that's what I do. And, you know, within, I think might have been 2 or 3 dates, we were engaged. Whew! Nice Catholic boy from Atlanta, and I'm a nice Catholic girl from Connecticut, and, you know, whoo, it's going to be wonderful. Call the family, and we called the family, and they're all like, great. So, anyway, so 4 years later, we're not married. We're living together, and we've made no plans to get married, by the way, either. You know, and but we have a life together, and we know each other's families, and da 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 da. And yet, nothing's moving on. And I'm slowly getting some recovery, and in this relationship, which is good. I mean, it was really important, and. One of the reasons I moved to Atlanta was because this wonderful, wonderful man, I mean, he really is a wonderful man, told me that if we could just move back to Atlanta, which is, he's from here, his family's from here, everything would be better. we should move, and now, by the way, he was still in school and I was working, so I was the sole support of our little family, and so we should move to Lake Linnea and live on the lake, and he would stop drinking and he would stop doing cocaine because everything was better. It really was New York City that was causing all our problems. Now I'm, 4 or 5 years into the program without a sponsor, so, but nonetheless, I'm working it. You know, I'm going to meetings and I'm sharing and I'm being honest, and I'm in a women's group of women in AA and in Al-Anon, and really, really working to overcome these, my issues, and to feel good about myself regardless of who I was with. And, I got better about, I'm okay no matter what job I have. I'm okay no matter where I live. But I still wasn't okay whether I had a man in my life or not, and who that man was. Because that man had to measure up. He had to be certain things. And most of all, it was funny. And Peter, God love him, he was the funniest drunk I knew. He just was a funny, funny man. But later on, it wasn't so funny. But, Anne from last night, but different Anne will say, she says, it tells that when the AAs tell the story and there's all this laughing and da-da-da, it tells a lot better than it lives on the other side. So, the alcoholics are roaring with laughter and the Al-Anons are, oh. So, anyway. Through a series of a lot of different, so that started, and we started looking for a house here in Atlanta. We were going to move in Atlanta. I was looking for a job here in Atlanta. And, it's funny enough when you're in the disease and you pray for something to happen and God gives it to you. And so, we prayed for me to get this job in Atlanta, and I did. And God love him, my fiancé, just, he couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. So that summer he really, really acted out. He was spending the summer away. I was in New York, and he finally crossed a line that I couldn't let go. And so we broke up. And ironically enough, I still moved down to Atlanta, and he couldn't believe that I moved alone, because the only people I knew here were his friends and his family. I knew no one else. So I packed up my car. Now the company was going to move my stuff. So I just packed up my car with my clothes and my pillow and my stuffed animals and drove to Atlanta. I left on Saturday, spent the night in the D.C. area on Saturday night, and landed here Sunday afternoon at the, not the Holiday Inn, but one of those places right on off of North Druid. And I called Mays, and I had come down on my interview. I had found Mays. It was on Wayuka at that time, those many years ago. And I was new to Atlanta. I was in a rental car. I just had an interview, and I was pretty sure I was going to get the job offer, so I wanted a meeting list. So I found out where Mays was, and I got I got on on 285 at Roswell Road, and went the wrong way. So I drove the perimeter, all 60 miles of it, to get back to Wayuka. But by God, I was getting that meeting list. So there was commitment to my recovery. So I did get the meeting list, and I headed back home to New York. And so when I did, when I landed in Atlanta that night, that Sunday night, there was a meeting on Sunday nights at the Lutheran Church up the street on North Druid Hills. I don't even think the church is there. I think they knocked the church down now. But so I was in a meeting my very first night in Atlanta because I didn't know anybody else. And I went to meetings every night just in that area. Went to meetings at NABA, Skyland, Tucker, and just every night I landed in meetings because I took a tremendous leap of faith. And this was my third step. When I left New York, I really felt like I walked off the cliff, and that, and I just like held my hands out, and God came in and swooped me up and just landed me very, very safely and gently in Atlanta, and said, "This is the place for you." I don't know, and at the time, I was clear, I was terrified to leave New York, and my parents lived in Connecticut, and all my friends and family were in, you know, the Northeast, and it was just the right move. And I wasn't moving because of him. I was moving because of me. It was a time for me to make a change, and I didn't know why, but I went. And a lot of you know, I laugh because change and flexibility are not strong points of mine. You know, I never let go of anything without claw marks on it. And so, you know, that was really when I got the care of God, that I landed here in Atlanta, I landed in the rooms of Al-Anon, and I very quickly started building up friends and in these family groups. And my mother couldn't believe, they didn't know I was in the program at the time, and I couldn't understand how quickly I had friends. And how many friends? Just like, what's going on here? You know. And I love my mom and dad. And the main reason I didn't ever tell them about, I didn't tell them I was in the rooms for a long, long time. And the reason I didn't is because I knew, you know, this much I did know. And true to form, my mother said it, which was, what did I do to raise you? How is it my fault? Now, my mother is a remarkable woman, and I love her dearly. And she is the ultimate caretaker, the ultimate enabler. And there are wonderful, I mean, when my mother passes, there will be hundreds, if not thousands, at her funeral of people she's helped. I mean, I'm not kidding you. It's just the way she is. And it is not a bad thing. But nonetheless, I didn't tell them. And I did land in Atlanta, and I didn't know a soul. Like I said, that I felt I could contact safely. And so I built up friends, and I built up a life here. And I learned to live single, like it says there. I started working the steps again. One of the very first meetings I went to over in Tucker on a Friday night, I heard this woman speak, and she was sharing her story. And I heard her say something that I thought, ooh, I could tell this woman my deepest, darkest secrets. I know I can. And, you know, I didn't trust anybody that much. I was slowly beginning to trust the rooms, that I could share in the rooms, but you certainly didn't know my deepest, darkest, you know. So, but I thought, you know, I think I could talk to her. So the next week I went back to the Monday night meeting at Tucker, and there she was. She was chairing, and she had someone up there speaking on sponsorship. So I thought, okay, God, I get it. So after the meeting, I mean, I literally felt the hand of God on my back just pushing me up towards her. And I asked her to be my sponsor, and she looked at me. She said, well, of course, honey. She took the phone list out, and she circled her name on it, and she said, you know, call me this week, and we'll talk. She said, my husband's in AA, so you don't have to worry about anonymity. You can talk to him. And I said, thank you. And then I ran all the way out to the parking lot so that she wouldn't, you know, decide she changed her mind. And, you know, little did I know, you know, she can remember my name now most of the time. But then she kind of thought to herself, I wonder who the hell was that? And thought, well, if she calls me, I'll figure it out. So, so here we are. 16 years later, my sponsor and I, and we, you know, I did call, and I did get her husband the first time. Oh, Lord, God love him. Dennis Sanfilippo, who is now gone to the big AA meeting in the sky, up there with Owen, God love him. They're playing golf and arguing, I'm sure. Just, you know, he was busily at that time saving Al-Anons. He saved a lot of our lives, according to him, you know. But scared the daylights out of me, Dennis did. Big, gruff, loving alcoholic, and learned a lot from him. And so I started getting sponsored by Barbara, and we started meeting, and she said, you know what, I really feel comfortable. Normally I would start you back on the first step, but I feel really comfortable that you have the first three, so let's get writing on your inventory. And so true to form, I always wait till the last minute for everything. So, you know, I'd had, I don't know, a couple of weeks, and she, you know, before we were going to get together, and it was a Saturday, I was going to go over to her house and do my fifth step. And, you know, Friday night, I'm writing my fourth step right before. So, you know, I didn't just, and I remember she said, you know, if you have any questions and you want to call and you can't get me, you can always ask Dennis. And so I remember calling him up once and asking him, and he's like, "You idiot, God is the solution." I'm like, "Thanks, Dennis." I always remember that. And the other thing was, if you had a problem, Dennis was, "Did you pray about it?" "Yeah." "Then grab a newcomer and shut up." So, you know, things were simpler then, you know? Okay. So, and I was used to, I mentioned I was in a women's group with, in New York City, and I do want to go back to that just for a minute, because I was the only Al-Anon. I was the token Al-Anon, and all the other women were recovering in AA. And I learned early on in my recovery to work my program as my life depended on it, because these women did. Because they knew, when I came into the program, what I heard was the alcoholic will either get sober, go crazy, or die. There was no options, other options. Those were the three choices. And so I watched those women stay sober because their lives depended on it. They didn't want to end up in an insane asylum, and they didn't want to die. And I knew that even though I didn't drink, I was dying a spiritual death every day that I compromised myself and compromised my God and compromised the person that I was meant to be by, you know, engaging in the active disease of alcoholism. So I, so those women were an example to me. And while Dennis was scary, and then meeting a lot of the men that he sponsored was scary, it still was, I could meet him halfway, and it was a great lesson to me. He became somewhat of a father figure to me. I was his golf wife. Barbara hated to play golf, and I wanted to play golf, and Dennis wanted to play in the mixed pairs that they would have on Sunday mornings at this country club. And so he and I would play together, and I was really horrible, I gotta tell you. But, you know, I could tend to hit straight, I just could never hit very far. And I always had to go to the bathroom every three or four holes, which just used to irritate him no end. "What? You have to go to the bathroom again?" And I'd be sitting there contemplating what club to hit, and, you know, what, and of course we weren't playing fast enough for Dennis. He'd be, "Any club in the bag, just move it!" Talk about a spiritual golf experience. No enjoying nature and the being together, and threw me out of a golf cart once. Not purposely, but he was in a hurry. We were making the turn from 9 to 10. My butt wasn't quite in the chair yet. He went around the corner, and I flung out into the middle of the road, no less. And he did manage to remember that I wasn't with him. He came back and got me. Anyway, we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. So, you know, did 4, 5, and 6, made my list of amends, and 7, 8, and 9, and went to the real physical amends I needed to make was in my journey, my monologue, which started when I started betraying women. I betrayed my best friend with her boyfriend back, you know, when I was 16, and my best friend. And we had grown up together, and back then they used to arrange you in homerooms by alphabetically. So she and I sat together, you know, we were, you know, last names, bing, bing, right together for, I don't know, 10 years. So it was a big, big betrayal, and it was, you know, indicative of how I would proceed throughout the rest of my life. So I flew back to Connecticut, to meet with her. There was her brother had been killed accidentally, and they used to have a golf championship in his honor, a tournament rather, and my brothers and my father and I would play in it every year. So that year after I had my 9-step list, I flew back to Connecticut to play in the tournament, and I met with her, and I talked to her about that. And, you know, it was many, many years later, but she remembered it as well, and she was married, and she had children, and I was not. And but I remember what a wonderful feeling it was. And the main thing on my 9-step was to make my amends in changed behaviors, to be a better me, to be a better daughter, to be a better sister, to be a better friend, and not engage in the behaviors that I had done in the past. You know, I didn't steal money, I stole men. I didn't you know, didn't wreak havoc in the sense of as much out in the outside world as I did in here. And so a lot of it was just changing my behavior and feeling proud of myself at the end of the day and feeling like I had done, as another friend of mine says, live my life as a prayer. Just for that day, did I live my life as good as I could? Would God be proud of me today? And so it's interesting in the big book that the promises come right after the ninth step. And all I knew at that point, and it was the summer of 95, and I was doing, I did my fifth step, and then through my ninth step, made my ninth step amends in July or August of that summer. And I knew at that point that for the first time in my life, I was okay. I got down on my knees and I said to God, you know what? I have a really good life. I have wonderful friends. I have a good family that I have a good relationship with today. I know that nobody on this planet can make me whole or make me happy. That comes from you, God, and my life is good. I would like to have a husband, a partner, a lover, a friend, but if that's not in the cards for me, if that's not your will for me, I'm okay, and I know I'm okay, and thank you, God, for this life that I have. And so I flew up and made my amends to my girlfriend and came back, and there was a July 4th party at a mutual friend's of ours, at AA, an Al-Anon couple, and a big group, and it was all recovery people, a lot of fun. We did a lot of partying back then. And so this fellow walked in, and my sponsor looked at him, and she had a God shot. And she said, she looked at me, she went, do you think he's cute? And I was like, yeah, he is kind of cute. And she said, oh, okay. So she goes out on the porch, poor guy, he wasn't even a year sober yet. And she sits him down, and there are alcoholics around the city of Atlanta that are terrified of my sponsor. And Dennis, their sponsor, could call them, and they'd be like, and Barbara would call them. So my husband to this day is still terrified of Barbara. Pray that she'll give him an assignment. So she went out in the back and quizzed him. Who's your sponsor? What step are you on? How long have you been sober? Blah, 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 blah. And he's answering her. He doesn't know who she is, by the way. Oh, actually, I take that back. He does know who she is. And anyway, so she just files that away. And it's her her belly button birthday is in September, so she was gonna have, we were gonna have go to one of those Japanese steakhouses with a big U, and she said, I'm gonna call Ward and ask him to take you to my birthday dinner as a blind date. Are you okay with that? Okay. Now, I had already done my fifth step with this woman, and I have learned in my relationship with her a couple of things. One was unconditional love, because before I took my fifth step, before I gave her my fifth step, she said to me, we prayed together, and we got down on our knees and we prayed together, and she said, no matter what you tell me, no matter what's on this paper, I will love you. I will always love you. There is nothing here that will make me stop loving you. And I believed her. And so I told her all my down and dirty, the worst things, you know, and later on I, you know, was astonished to find out that she was just trying to stay awake. You know, pouring on her. Barbara was like, you know, I've heard so many. It's really, there's really very, very little that surprises me these days. Thanks. So I learned how to be a good friend through that. And you know, 16 years later, I can say that she's not only my sponsor, but she's my friend. So there's that. I learned to trust her and to trust her instincts and to trust her God, and to, you know, just when she got a God shot like that, just go with it. So I went with it, and true to form, Dennis called Ward and said, Barbara wants you to call him, and left him, and you know, like 5 minutes later the phone rings, and I happened to be at their house, and Ward's like, he says, what should I do? He, you know, when they proposed the idea to him, he's like, oh, okay, what should I do? And Dennis said, call her. So he called me, and it was Labor Day weekend of 1995, September 2nd, actually, Sunday, September 2nd. I don't remember so well. And we talked for 3 hours on the phone, and just talked and talked and talked, and I thought, wow, That's pretty impressive. And then that Monday, we agreed to go to a Monday matinee movie. It was Labor Day, because I think we felt like a night date would be too much pressure. So we went out and fell in love. Now, you know, coming from where I come from, I was really leery of this because I thought, oh God, this can't be happening this fast, this quick. And but I had a lot of women, I had a lot of strengths around me who said, just because it's fast doesn't mean it's not right. And so we were engaged within a month and a half, but then I wanted to be married in the church, and he had been married before, and so the church asked us to wait a year and a half, and we did. And we went through, you know, some spiritual counseling together, and got married in April of 1997. So, you know, we practice our program together, and the most telling thing, the most intimate thing that my husband and I do together, and we did before we got involved, was to get down on our knees and pray together. And we get down on our knees and we pray together every morning. We say the third and seventh step prayer together to go out into the day, because when we got engaged, my sponsor and her husband took us through the 12 traditions of Al-Anon, because they said, you know, if the 12 traditions can keep however many millions of Al-Anon family groups together, they can certainly keep this little family of two together. And so we studied the traditions as couples, and we learned how to apply the traditions in the home, because it is all about just keeping unity. And so our recoveries come first, his sobriety, my serenity comes first, and then each other. And now, and then after that, our child. And so we got married, and we've had our ups and our downs, and you know, life happens. About 3 years after we got married, it was kind of time. I had always wanted children, and that was he had an adult child already, and he was kind of but that was a deal we made that you know we would try. And so, the summer of 1999, it was like, okay, you know, it's either now or never. So we tried. I got pregnant right away. We were both in shock. And of course, he was running around. Yes. I was due on June 10th of year 2000. And but she wasn't coming, and June 10th was a Saturday, and I was actually in an all-day workshop on the traditions of the steps, I don't recall which, at my church. And the Friday before, that Friday I'd gone to my OB, and I just was like, oh God, you got to, I might, please take this baby. She's like, what makes you, and she said, why? I said, I'm so tired. And she said, you think you're going to get more rest after you have the baby? And I was like, yeah. I'm up every hour and a half now. If I get 3 hours, I'm good. So she said, okay, fine. You know, your blood pressure's a little bit up, and, you know, you passed your due date. If you don't go naturally over the weekend, we'll admit you on Monday, and we'll induce. So went in Monday night. Tuesday morning, they induced labor. And after she started it, and I went right into labor. I did go right into labor, but she said to me, my OB, before she went across the street to her office to do some, have some appointments, she said, you know, just because you're in labor does not mean we'll have a baby today. And I looked at her and I went, ooh, we're having a baby today. We are taking this baby whether you take it or I push it. I don't care. So anyway, 3 hours later, the nurse comes in to check on me. My mom's here, Ward's here, and my sponsor's en route, and it was around 11:30, and I said, go downstairs to the cafeteria and have, they said it was going to take a while, so go have some lunch. And around quarter to noon, somewhere in there, the nurse comes in, just kind of take a check. She goes, oh my God, you're going to have this baby. I went, oh, I can't have this baby. My mom and my husband are downstairs. And I don't Well, as you know, God is so good. Down the hall is another woman in the program I know real well, Ann and Jimmy, and their daughter is having a baby. And I know she's in the hospital because she's come to say hello to me. Go down the hall. This girl's having a baby. Her mom's there, and she knows my mom. She knows my husband. Tell them, go get my husband and bring him back up here. Ann comes running in. What's going on? I'm going to help you. She's like, okay, no worries. She runs down the cafeteria. And anyway, net is, you know, my husband, they'd already eaten, and the board was came back up, and my mom was lollygagging in the guest in the shops to buy me something. And then she comes wandering, and I hadn't had the baby yet, so thank God. I'm like, Mom, where you been? Oh, shopping. So anyway, I had my daughter at 2 o'clock on the dot on June 13th, the year 2000, my Al-Anon birthday. And she, if you do not believe in God, then you only have to look at my little girl and know that God is present in my life. And if your God isn't, you know, strong enough for you, you can rely on mine, because mine is really good. And I teach Sunday school to second and third graders. In fact, I would just be finishing up right about now. I try to summarize the lesson every day, every Sunday for them, and that they can understand. And so every day they walk out, every Sunday they walk out, and now they know what to do. I go, okay, 1, 2, 3, and they'll go, God is good, and they walk out. Because you know what, at that age and early in recovery, all we need to know is God is good. All I need to know is that I was loved when I first walked in these rooms, and that God loved me, and that you loved me. And at first I only saw God in your faces. And God doesn't talk to me. I don't have to see burning bushes. And, you know, I remember hearing a woman once who shared that she got notes from God. You know, literally notes would drift down from the heavens and land in her yard. And I was like, damn, I never get notes. But anyway, so the greatest gift of my recovery, I shouldn't say that. My daughter is wonderful. And like I said, she keeps me humble, and she... every time I look at her, I see God, and I remind myself of you know, what's really, really important. And but I also remember my sponsor holding her as she was minutes old, and she looked at me, my sponsor looked at me, and she said, "See her? She still knows what God looks like." Mm-hmm. And I went, because you know, we're born, we know what God looks like. We know that feeling, that total. You know, we start to separate as we get older, and we, you know, get more wisdom, and life experience pulls us away from God. It doesn't naturally, for me anyway, pull me closer to God. And that's what the 12 steps of Al-Anon and the program of Al-Anon have given me, have brought me to God, or back to God. And that's the greatest gift that I could ever imagine. So I have my story is one of hope and joy. I have a wonderful husband. I have a beautiful daughter. I have wonderful friendships. I have a great family. But at the end of the day, I have my God, and I'm okay because God loves me, because God is good. And so I'm going to close with this one prayer that keeps me sane, and because my greatest way of indulging in my disease is fear and worry. Like I said, I used to be too afraid to live and too afraid to die. I had stomach issues. I have ulcerative colitis that I have had since I was 18 years old. I'm proud to tell you that this year I've been given a 2-year pass on having, you know, checkups, because my disease has been in remission for 3 solid years at a microscopic level. I tell you that because I firmly believe that this is a physical, emotional, and spiritual disease, and my physical problems are always a manifestation of my spiritual health. And so I believe I got colitis because my stomach was always so tense. I never, you know, I just did not breathe. I didn't breathe, as Ann told me to last night. But I also talked to you earlier, I said about not being flexible, and I had knee surgery right before Christmas because, you know, your knees are all about being flexible and moving forward. And for some reason, for all the years of my life, I plant in place and I pull my, I wait, you know. And I believe that's why I needed knee surgery, and I have arthritis in that knee. And I'm here to tell you, I've been discharged from physical therapy. I have full motion in that knee. I do have arthritis. I have bone on bone, and I feel great. You know, it just, God has said, okay, Cindy, you know, this is what you've done, but here's what you can do to make it better. And so, you know, the physical symptoms of this disease can be made better through spiritual recovery, and I believe that sincerely. So anyway, with that, I'm going to close with this prayer. It says, let nothing disturb you. Let nothing make you afraid. All things are passing. God never changes. Patience obtains all things. Nothing is lacking to the one who has God. God alone is enough. Thank you.